Did God really wipe out the population of the ancient earth with a great flood? And if there was a flood, was it global or was it local? And what was the earth like before the great flood? We're going to talk about these topics on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. Please check it out. Ton of great information there. And this is the first podcast of 2018, working on my second year of podcasting. So thanks for hanging around for the first year, and hopefully the second year will be as good, if not better, and I can be a little more regular with my podcast posts. So we are on the second dispensation. We have talked about, we spent most of the last part of last year talking about the first dispensation. So please go back and check out those links to find out what the dispensations are, why I call them dispensations, what the first dispensation entailed. And at the end of last year, my last podcast was about the second dispensation. So the first dispensation, or just to give you kind of the cliff notes, the dispensations are God's contrastive way of showing that his plan for man is the only one that can work. And he does that by doing a series of questions that he asks man during different eras of time, and to give man the opportunity to either choose himself over God or choose God over himself. And man has failed and will continue to fail every dispensation until God finally implements his plan. The first dispensation, the question was, if man was completely innocent with no knowledge of good and evil, would he choose God over himself? Would he be contrastive? Would he choose to be right and just and godlike on his own and therefore qualify for God's plan? The answer, of course, was no. In the second dispensation, which we covered in the last podcast, God took the opposite tact. Instead of putting man in a situation where he had very little knowledge and no knowledge of what good and evil truly were, and we talk about those definitions in the last podcast, the last several podcasts of the year, if man had a ton of knowledge instead of having low knowledge, if man was given time, given a long lifespan to accumulate massive amounts of knowledge, would that knowledge lead him to choose God over himself? And again, the answer was no. In fact, not only did that increased knowledge not lead man to God, it progressively led him further and further away from God. In Genesis chapter 6, after having hundreds of years of life, in fact, the antediluvian, and that's antediluvian is a term for the pre-flood era, the antediluvian man lived about an average of 700 years, and there were tens of millions, if not billions, of people on earth, and they all had hundreds of years to accumulate knowledge. And Genesis chapter 6 says that at the end of this massive lifespan, man's thoughts were constantly evil. In other words, they started as, you know, probably a mixture of some good and some evil, to actually being completely evil. So the older they became, the more they learned, the more evil they became, until after 700-ish years of life, they were completely evil. They went so far away from God that there were no good thoughts left in their minds. He says their thoughts were evil constantly. So 24/7, they thought nothing but evil, the more knowledge they gained. So it would appear that the only just thing for God to do would be to curtail the lifespan of men. And as a part of doing that, he had to wipe out all of humanity. Seems a little extreme. I mean, there were tens of millions, if not billions, of people on the earth, and he wiped out just about all of them except for 8 people, Noah, his wife, and Noah's 3 sons and their wives. Again, seems kind of extreme, but there was actually a pretty logical and reasonable reason for it, which we will explore in at the end of this series on the second dispensation. And it actually touches on some very controversial stuff that has to do with understanding who the sons of God are in Genesis chapter 6. But that's for later. So basically, knowledge did not lead man closer to God. It led him away from God. So they had knowledge of God, but it seems they didn't believe in God. They lacked faith. Faith is that bridge between knowledge and belief. And in the next podcast, we're going to begin a series on faith and talk about why faith is so important to God and why it is so important to us. But before we do that, I want to spend this podcast talking about the actual physical aspects of the flood itself, because the flood, if you think about it, it seems kind of fanciful. I mean, it's one of those Bible stories that we hear when we're kids, and you know, it makes sense at the time because when we're kids, you know, we're accepting knowledge and everything that we're told. You know, we imagine that it's true, and we love those kind of stories. But as you grow older, especially if you become more exposed to the secular world, you will find that the secular world really disparages a lot of the stories, especially when they have to do with anything miraculous in the Bible. And they will say things like, "Oh, well, there wasn't really a flood. That's just a, you know, crazy Bible story. There wasn't this guy who built this gigantic boat and that he put two of every animal on. That's just a children's story. You can't really believe that that happened." But it's in the Bible. And if we believe that the Bible is true, if we're Christians, and we have to believe that the Bible is true, all of it, we can't just pick and choose the parts of the Bible that we like and then ignore the others. Even though a lot of us try to do that, we really can't. Either it's all the Word of God or it's not. And if it is all the Word of God, if all of it is from the divine source that's always and completely right and just and completely perfect and knows everything, then every part of the Bible should be taken seriously, including the idea that the entire world was flooded. But that leads us to ask a question. Is there evidence for it? You know, we can believe the Bible based on faith, and we'll talk about faith at the beginning of the next podcast, but this podcast and the whole faith by reason method, the whole faith by reason modus operandi, is that if the Bible is true, then it should make sense logically. And if the flood is true and it makes sense logically, then there should be evidence that the entire world was flooded. I mean, there should be plenty of evidence of it. And if there isn't evidence, then why do we believe it? And that's what we're going to dive into on this podcast. And we'll start with the basic question of, was there really a flood? Well, if there was really a flood, then there should be historical and physical evidence of it. Is there? Well, absolutely there is. Although the secularists and the atheists want to disparage the idea of a flood, they can't, because when you look at worldwide cultures, all the ancient cultures, all the historic records that we have from the ancient cultures, you will find that every ancient culture that existed between 4 and 6,000 years ago, they all have a narrative in their history of a great flood. And we believe that the great flood happened during that time span, somewhere between 4 and 6,000 years ago. Every ancient culture around the world that has any type of written language, they all have a flood narrative. You look at one of the most ancient historical renderings from Sumeria. The Epic of Gilgamesh talks about a great worldwide flood. And that's in the Middle East, in Sumeria, which is kind of the Iran-Iraq area, Mesopotamia. But then if you go to the Americas, the ancient Native Americans, the Aztecs, the Incas, the Mayans, they all have a narrative about a great flood. You go to Asia, China has narratives about the Great Flood. All around the world, these ancient cultures all have narratives that they have written down about a Great Flood. And that's what our history is based on. No matter how secular you might be, if you're a historian, you have to acknowledge that history has recorded a Great Flood that happened between 4 and 6,000 years ago. You can't get away from that. No, if you deny that, then you're denying history. And if you're denying history, you're being unscientific. And there's nothing a secularist hates more than being unscientific. So they have to admit that history shows that a great flood existed. Now, how do they get around that? They get around it by doing something that not only they do, but also some Christians do. Because Christians, unfortunately, get embarrassed by some of the miraculous stuff in the Bible. And it's mostly because they're cowards. We talked about this when we did the series on evolution versus creation. And in the very last one, I talked about how Darwinism is a religion. And it's been allowed. And it's a ridiculous religion. It's absolutely impossible. Darwinian evolution is impossible. Not improbable. Not unlikely. Impossible. Go back. Go to the categories. Check on the... And look in the archives and you can see I had a couple podcasts on that and show why it's a completely ludicrous theory. And it's easily disproven. I disproved it in about 30 minutes. And so it completely disproved it. Yet Christians are still afraid to confront the evolutionists on this because they're intentionally ignorant of what the Bible really says and what science really says. So instead of confronting the atheist, the agnostic, the angry secularist when they come at them, they go into a shell. So when the atheist says, "Oh, you really believe your silly Bible says there was a worldwide flood?" Well, the cowardly Christian, and not all of us are cowardly. You're not, because you're listening to this podcast and you're gaining knowledge. But unfortunately, the average Christian who's a coward says, "Oh, well, maybe it wasn't a great flood. Maybe it was only a local flood." See, that's one of the secularists' favorite things to do when they come up with the flood. They can't deny that there was a flood because the historic record bears it out. But they'll say, "Well, it wasn't a worldwide flood. It was just a local flood. It was a local flood to the Mediterranean area. That's where the Bible writers lived. And so it was just a local flood. The Mediterranean Sea flooded, maybe as far east as Mesopotamia. And because to them, that was the whole world, that was their world, they said that the world was flooded." And Christians will agree with them. "Oh yeah, it was just a local flood." And unfortunately, a lot of Christian denominations will just say that the flood wasn't worldwide, it was local. But what's the evidence? Is there evidence that the flood was worldwide? Yes, there absolutely is. There is no need to bow down and kowtow to the atheists who try to make fun of you, because you have the facts on your side. As I said in the podcast on evolution, the facts bear out that the Bible is true and secular history is wrong. There was a worldwide flood. How do we know that? Well, number one, as I just said before, cultures from around the world have a flood narrative. How can a flood be local to the Mediterranean if Asian ancient records, if North American and South American legends history and Mesopotamian history all record a flood? That means the flood had to be all over the world, because people from all over the world recorded the flood. Why would the Aztecs and the Incas and the Mayans in Central America record a flood that happened just in the Middle East? That would be ridiculous. So that's one evidence. The other evidence we have is the fact that if you look at a lot of our mountainous areas, let's take the Himalayas. That's a great example because that's the highest mountain range in the world. There is no area in the world that is higher than the Himalayas. The Himalayas, you will find that there are fossils of sea life in these mountains, which means that these mountains were at one point underwater. So if the tallest mountain range in the world was underwater, then that means that the rest of the world had to be underwater. There is a ton of evidence, physiological, geological evidence, that the flood was worldwide. In fact, there'll be a link I'll put into the show notes that go to the IRC, Creation Research Organization, that will give you a ton of links where you can do the research for yourself. But there is a lot of evidence that there was a huge worldwide flood. Even another one that we're all familiar with if you live in America. Or even if you don't, you should know about it. The Grand Canyon. Grand Canyon is, again, the largest canyon in the world. It's spectacular. I've visited there myself as I was a kid. My dad took us on a trip to the Grand Canyon. And it's majestic. It's magnificent. But if you go to the Grand Canyon, or if you read about it in books, they will tell you something very, very silly. They will tell you that the Grand Canyon is huge, enormous canyon that is miles wide, was formed through gradual erosion over millions of years, because they're evolutionists, and in evolution, everything takes millions of years to happen, because that's how they try to rationalize the fact that their theory is ludicrous. They try to put a bunch of years on it to make you think, well, okay, it couldn't happen in the short term. It's dumb in the short term, but maybe if you give it a bunch of years, the impossible can happen, which it can't. Again, go back to this series on evolution, and you'll see why. They would tell you that over millions of years, the Colorado River carved the Grand Canyon. Now, when I was a kid, that even though, you know, you're predisposed as a child to believe what adults tell you, and I tried to believe it because adults were telling me that, but it didn't make any sense. Why? Because you look at the Grand Canyon and you look at the Colorado River, and there is a serious incongruity there. The Colorado River is relatively tiny. It's skinny. It's only, you know, so many feet wide. So many yards wide, and the Grand Canyon is miles wide. There is no way on earth this little tiny river could have carved out this wide, gigantic canyon. It's not. The reason that the Grand Canyon is carved out is because water, which can move earth in tremendous ways, rushed through that area and carved the Grand Canyon out. There is no way on earth that tiny river did it. But evolutionists choose to believe the impossible, which is that this little river, the Colorado River, could have carved out the Grand Canyon. Utterly impossible. All you have to do is look at it and apply 5 minutes of logic, and you realize there is no way on earth that that could have happened any other way than either the flood carved it out, or it could be that, you know, a great glacier carved it out. But that glacier came from water, and that water came from the great flood. So tons of evidence for a worldwide flood. And as I said, I will give you links in the show notes to all the different evidences. There's so many, it would take me hours to go through every single one, but it can't be disputed by anyone who actually pays attention to the geological evidence that the world was flooded. But that leads to an even more intriguing question. And that question is, if the world was flooded, and it was, well, what was the world like before the Great Flood? You have to figure a flood that covered the entire earth in water was pretty cataclysmic, and it had to have had tremendous changes to the topology of the earth. Not only to topology, to the weather patterns of the earth, to the way the earth rotates, to the way our current world is. It would be very traumatic experience, a cataclysmic thing to happen. And we only know what the world is like post-flood. That's the world we live in. None of us alive have ever seen what the world was like before the flood. But you have to assume that it must have been very, very different, because having that much water coming to the earth in a short period of time would have had, again, tremendous impact. The Grand Canyon being one of them. And again, tons of other impacts. And we know what the world is like on this side of the flood, but what was the world like before the flood? Well, the truth is, we don't have a ton of information, but we have some information. We can use that information to extrapolate and maybe paint a picture of what the world was like before the flood. So let's talk about that a bit. What was the world like before the flood? Well, one thing we know is that there was no rain before the flood. The Bible is very clear that it didn't rain before the flood. In fact, when Noah was building his ark, when God ordered him, hey, go build this ark, you know, people would walk by and say, Noah, what on earth are you doing building this gigantic boat sitting here in your driveway? Why are you building a boat? And Noah said, well, because it's going to rain. Like, rain? What are you talking about? It's never rained. So the people were, I'm sure they were disparaging to Noah, saying, why are you building this boat expecting rain when there's never been rain? Well, if there was never rain, well, how was there vegetation? How did plants grow? How did people get water? Well, a few ways. Well, the Bible says in Genesis chapter 3, chapters 2 and 3, that there was a mist that went up from the earth that watered all the plant life. So what does that tell us about the earth pre-flood? Well, it tells us that if there was a mist coming up, so there had to be enough water coming up to water everything. That'd be a pretty thick mist. So that mist means had to be very tropical. That means the earth, for the most part, was uniformly tropical. There may have been a few areas that were not, but for the most part, the earth had a very tropical atmosphere. Any of you who've ever been to the Caribbean or been to Hawaii or places like that have a very tropical nature, you know that, you know, the air is pretty thick. It feels thick. I mean, it's thick because it has not only the air we breathe, but there's just a lot of vapor, a lot of moisture in the air. It's very, very humid. What else can we extrapolate from this mist coming from the earth? Well, in addition to the earth being tropical, you have to assume that the earth didn't have oceans the way we have them now. It didn't have a Pacific Ocean or an Atlantic Ocean or an Indian Ocean. How do we know that? Because those oceans that we currently have cause rain because of the water cycle, from the evaporation of clouds that come down and then the clouds condense and produce rain. There's never been... You can't... If oceans existed, there would have been rain. So there could not have been oceans. But there have to have been enough water to cause the mist to come up from the earth to water all the vegetation. That means that the earth was probably filled with a lot of shallow seas. And by that I mean, you know, really, really large lakes, maybe the size of the Great Lakes, and dotting the earth. So the earth was covered, instead of with oceans, there was a lot more landmass, and it was covered with shallow seas. And that great landmass could have, you know, easily supported all the many people who were on the earth. and, you know, giving them plenty of land to grow crops and you know, food and livestock and all those sorts of things. Even though actually man didn't eat vegetable, didn't eat meat at that time. We were all vegetarians. God did not command man to eat meat until after the flood. So everyone was vegans, which means they were really, really annoying, because vegans are some of the most annoying people on earth, right behind atheists. So anyway, we know that the earth, we believe that the earth was covered with shallow seas, and there was probably a lot of groundwater, a lot of aquifers, and so the topography was very different. In addition to that, there's reason to believe that the earth was much, much flatter than it is now. The earth is covered with tons of mountain ranges, and those mountain ranges were pushed up after the flood. But pre-flood, the earth was pretty flat in general. And I don't mean the earth was flat. I believe the earth is round. But I mean that the landmass itself may have had a few hills, but very, very few mountain ranges. And that would have contributed to that uniform climate of that uniform tropical climate. Another thing that uniform tropical climate would have produced is increased air pressure. Again, if you've ever been to the tropics, anywhere in the Caribbean or places like that, you will know that the air feels heavier, and it is for a reason. The reason is there is very high pressure, and that's actually a good thing. High air pressure condenses the amount of oxygen that people would breathe. So that would create what is called a hyperbaric effect. Hyperbaric means a very rich oxygen environment. In fact, some hospitals put people into what's called hyperbaric chambers, which are very enclosed tubes that they put people in, which have a very rich oxygen environment, and it promotes healing. So the more oxygen you're able to breathe, the faster your body heals. And that might be in addition to having pure genetics, being closer to the perfect Adam and Eve in their genetics. In addition to that, having that extra oxygen, having a hyperbaric effect across the entire earth was probably another reason why people lived so long, and maybe a reason why we don't live as long now when that effect left. So we have a tropical environment, heavy air pressure, hyperbaric effect, shallow seas. And another thing I think the rotation of the earth might have been a little different, because when all that water came on the earth, it probably slowed the rotation of the earth down, having that extra weight. And that means that the earth probably maybe rotated a little faster during the antediluvian period. And we know that the earth's rotation is slowing down. That's measurable. That's very scientific. The earth's rotation is measurably slowing down. Not so much you have to change your daily plans, but it's measurable, and it's constant, and it's happening. So that means that in the past the earth spun faster, and I think that the flood probably had an effect on that. Having all that water on the earth at one time crashing forward would probably affect the rotation of the earth. It would affect the wobble of the earth. It would also probably affect the tilt of the earth. Maybe the earth wasn't quite as tilted as it is now. It's tilted 23 degrees, which gives us our various seasons. And if all that water came on the earth at once, all that weight might have increased that tilt to 23 degrees, which means maybe that tilt was less during the antediluvian period, which would also contribute to a more uniform temperature. The more the earth is tilted, the more extreme the seasons become. So if the earth was less tilted during the antediluvian period, that would, again, contribute to a more constant and predictable climate. That would have easily made the earth far more tropical. And there's evidence for that. It's not just, you know, me coming up with this stuff. Fossils of the woolly mammoths, you'll find some of these, not you, but science staff have found the skeletons or fossils of woolly mammoths up in the northernmost areas of Canada and Russia. And it was evidence that they were eating in their stomachs preserved were tropical plants, which means that the tropics spread as far north as northern Canada and northern Russia, meaning that, again, the Earth's climate during this time was much different. It was much more tropical. And you might ask, well, why would a tropical animal need all the wool of a woolly mammoth? Well, again, getting off topic a little bit, but if you look at the actual hairs of the woolly mammoth, they were hollow, meaning they were not for warmth. They were probably for a different type of insulation, but that's neither here nor there. Except say those hollow hairs probably kept the woolly mammoth cool as easily as it would have, you know, insulated them from any type of other extreme temperatures, which they probably didn't really experience. So that's just a glimpse into what the antediluvian world might have looked like. We don't know exactly. Again, we're extrapolating a bit, but it seems that it would have been a far more optimal environment for humans to live and thrive. People in the tropics tend to live longer than people in other extreme areas. The hyperbaric effect would have made our lives better, would have made us stronger and longer lived, and would help us heal diseases faster. But so that's that there. Oh no, but wait, there's something I forgot to mention. Dinosaurs, that is always the bugaboo of creationists versus evolutionists. When the evolutionists always bring up, well, what about dinosaurs? You say that, you know, all God created the earth in 6 days and he created all the animals and then he created man right after that in 6 days. What about dinosaurs? Dinosaurs lived millions of years ago. How can you correlate the two? Well, the truth is that dinosaurs probably lived around the same time as man. And I'm not gonna get into a side of rabbit trail about all that, but I will say there is one logical reason to believe that dinosaurs did exist and could have existed at the same time, aside from the problems with the fossil record and the problems with aging of the earth, the age of the earth, and how they age these fossils. And you can look back at podcast 10 and 11 to go over that. But I think that a good thing to bring up right now is what the hyperbaric effect would have been on reptiles. Reptiles never stop growing. They don't. They're not like us. We kind of stop growing once we reach around, you know, our late 20s, early 30s. We don't grow anymore. We stay the same height. Not the same for reptiles. Reptiles continue to grow and expand. Now, there is a limit on how much they can grow based on nutrients and things like the air pressure we currently have in the environment that we currently have. However, if they were in the environment, the antediluvian environment, where they were in a hyperbaric situation, where they were in the tropics, again, the hyperbaric oxygen was there, and they lived in, assuming that the animals lived, if their lifespan was as long as human beings, or if they were expanded to the same exponential degree that humans were, and, you know, we live 10 times longer than we did, then that means that if the animals live 10 times longer as well, and animals like reptiles will continue to grow at 10 times their rate exponentially, then that could be a reason why there were so many gigantic animals in the fossil record that we don't see today. And it could also be an explanation of not only where dinosaurs came from, they're just really huge lizards, reptiles that continue to grow. And it might also explain why they died out so suddenly post-flood, because if you're that huge and you need to consume that much foodstuffs in order to survive, there wasn't as much. If the antediluvian Earth had this tropical environment where things were very fertile and there were plants and animals all over the world, and then after the flood, the environment was changed much more. They didn't live as long. They couldn't grow as large. Their food sources were far less plentiful due to the extremities of the extreme nature of the Earth's climate. Then that is a possible reason why these dinosaurs and other large creatures. Remember, if you look at the fossil record, there were tons of animals that were similar to the animals of today, but they were just much larger mammals and fish and, you know, sea creatures, land creatures were much, much bigger, gigantic tortoises that don't live anymore. And maybe the reason that they died out was because the environment was so changed that they just could not survive anymore. And I had an atheist friend of mine who would always ask me, well, you know, if the Bible is true, why doesn't it talk about dinosaurs? Well, because number one, the Bible is not a biology book. It's not a listing. The Bible is not there to list out the genus and species of every animal that ever existed. That's not its point. And secondly, the Bible actually does talk about dinosaurs, two of them in the book of Job. When I think around Job in the late 30s, early 40s of Job chapters, God talks about, when he's giving Job a science quiz, he talks about two animals that we don't really see anymore. One is called the Leviathan, and the other is called Behemoth. Leviathan, if you look at the description, is very clearly talking about a gigantic seafaring reptilian. It talks about its scales. It talks about, so it's obviously a reptile. It's not a fish because of the way it's described. It's a gigantic sea creature that is reptilian. It's a sea-going dinosaur. The behemoth is a land dinosaur. People try to say, oh, no, he's talking, the behemoth, he's describing an elephant. Well, no, it doesn't, because one of the descriptions of this creature called the behemoth is that its tail is like a cedar tree. If you've ever seen an elephant's tail, that's probably the least impressive thing about an elephant is its tail. It is certainly not like a cedar. It's more like a rope. So there is no creature that currently exists that matches the description of the behemoth. It is quite likely, if not pretty obviously, a land-going dinosaur, a large plant-eating dinosaur, just like the Leviathan is a large reptilian sea creature. So the Bible is describing two dinosaurs right there. So that's a possible explanation of where dinosaurs came from and possibly where they went, and without factoring in the so-called millions of years that the evolutionists use. So that's just something else to add to your apologetics repertoire. So now let's get into the flood itself. Where did all that water come from? Well, it says it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Well, but is that enough water to have covered the entire earth? Honestly, no. Excuse me. And that's one of the things secularists and atheists bring up. They say, you know, 40 days and 40 nights of rain would not have been enough to flood the earth. Well, they forget about two things. One, the earth was much flatter, meaning the flatter the landmass is, the much easier it is to flood it. I mean, if the Himalayas were you know, where they are today during the flood, it would take a ton of water to get all the way up to cover the tops of those mountains and even some of the other smaller mountains. But they didn't exist then. The earth was much flatter then. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the Bible is very clear that the water didn't just come from rain from the sky. The Bible says in the flood narrative that God opened up the fountains of the great deep. What does that mean? That means there was water underground. And that's probably where some of the mist came from, the water, the vegetation, the shallow seas, and the water from underground. Where did that water come from? Well, again, go back to Genesis chapter 1. When it said God moved upon the face of the waters. Because we talked about this back in the 10th podcast, where there was a judgment that happened. I believe it had to do with angelic beings who rebelled. I'm not going to get into that right now. We'll talk about that later. But the bottom line is, as a result of that judgment, the earth was covered with water. And then on the first day of biblical creation, God separated the waters that were above the earth from the waters that were below. So basically, God sent a bunch of the water that covered the earth underneath the land, so that dry land would appear. So there was a lot of water, a huge, huge amount of water under the earth during the antediluvian period. And when he said he opened up the fountain of the great deep, he meant that he opened up the earth and the water that was underneath the earth, enough water to cover the earth, came up from the earth. And that would have caused massive cataclysmic things to happen. That would have pushed up the mountains. That's where all the mountain ranges came from. That's why the Himalayas have fossilized sea creatures on it, because they were at one point underwater and they were pushed up. They were under shallow seas and they were pushed up by these fountains of the great deep opening. That's where all the water for the Pacific and Atlantic oceans came from. It wasn't just rain. I think the rain was a very small part of the floodwaters. Most of it came from underground. Tons and tons of water came from under the earth, and that's what lifted the ark up, and that's what flooded and destroyed all the life on the earth, was these the fountains of the great deep being opened. And as an aside, let's just talk about why all that water was necessary. For some reason, which I don't fully understand, God uses water when he judges of spiritual evil. As I said, Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, alludes very strongly to a judgment, a water judgment that happened after an angelic rebellion. And again, go back to the podcast and we'll talk about, and you can hear my theories on that, and we'll talk about it again in the future. But for whatever reason, water seems to not only judge spiritual evil, demonic evil, but it seems to be a container, a holding place for them. Which is why when at the end of Revelation, when there's a new heaven and a new earth, and we're living there without evil, the Bible is very clear that there are no more seas, sea, S-E-A-C, like there's no more water, no more oceans Why? Because I think those oceans are, in addition to, you know, being what they are for a water cycle, they're a container of evil. I'll give you an example. Let's look at the Sea of Galilee. In the Gospels, there are a couple of instances where there are some strong storms on the Sea of Galilee. There's one storm where Jesus is on a boat, he's below decks, he's sleeping, and the Sea of Galilee is raging, and the disciples, who by the way were accomplished fishermen, were scared to death that they were going to die. They were going to, you know, be capsized. And Jesus came out and he said, "No, peace, be still," and he rebuked the waters. Interesting thing, we'll get back to that in a second. He rebuked the waters and the sea was calm. Then there was another time there was a storm on the waters, and that's when Jesus walked on the disciples were on a boat by themselves fishing. Then they saw Jesus walking on the water, and that's where, you know, Peter came out to him, so forth and so on. But here's the thing about the Sea of Galilee. It's not that big. I mean, you would expect for this Sea of Galilee, if it was able to produce its own weather patterns, to be pretty big. Like, say, the Great Lakes, like Lake Michigan and Lake Huron and Lake Superior, they're so big that they can actually produce their own weather effects. There's something called like lake effect snow that's very familiar to you if you live in the Midwest. That, you know, there's so much water there, so much condensation, evaporation, that the Great Lakes can actually cause their own weather patterns, like, you know, the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. But they're huge lakes. The Sea of Galilee is relatively tiny. If you go into Google Maps and Google the Sea of Galilee, you have to zoom in quite a bit from Israel to see that Sea of Galilee. It's a lake. It's not really a sea. It's the Lake of Galilee. It's too small to produce its own weather patterns. It can't. It's just too tiny to produce its own weather patterns, which means that weather pattern was demonic. These were, you know, demonic spiritual entities trying to kill Jesus and the disciples, which is why the disciples were so freaked out about it. These were men, and well, younger men, the disciples were, who had fished the Sea of Galilee all their lives. They would have experienced everything you could have experienced on the Sea of Galilee. Why were they frightened about these storms? Because they were unnatural. They were demonic, because in the Sea of Galilee, as well as probably many other bodies of water, there are demonic entities who are trapped for whatever reason. I don't fully understand it, honestly, but water seems to be a container. Great bodies of water seem to be a container for demonic evil, where God has trapped them or judged them through water. So that's where a lot of the water from the flood came from. After the judgment in Genesis 1, chapter verse 2, and God separated those waters out. And he sent them all underground. The fountain, he opened up those fountains, and that great pressure from all that water coming up caused the earth to ripple, to bunch up on either side of these fountains opening, and that created all the mountain ranges that we know today. It raised the mountains, it sank valleys, and it created the oceans as we have them. But that was not the case pre-flood. Pre-flood, there were no huge oceans, but we have them today, and it's a normal part of our lives and of our climate, having these oceans, but they didn't exist before. So our world, our weather was very, very different then. And now we live, again, post-flood, and we only know this world post-flood, but the pre-flood world, the antediluvian world, was, again, very different. And that's one of the contributing factors to our lives being much shorter. We don't have the hyperbaric effect anymore. We don't have that oxygen-rich environment. We don't have that universal tropical climate where there's, like, abundant food for everyone. You know, again, abundant oxygen in that high-pressure area. We don't have that anymore. The winds are more intense because of the oceans and because of the mountains. And so, yeah, the earth is a much, even though the earth is beautiful, and, you know, I've traveled around the country and around the world a bit, and we live on a very beautiful planet, but it's just a shell of what it was, of the beauty it probably had in the antediluvian period. And the combination of the world being much less hospitable, that's one of the reasons that we have deserts, is because the climate has changed so much. I'm not talking about Al Gore climate change. I'm talking about God-induced global climate change from the flood. You know, we have deserts and we have arid areas. We have tundras. We didn't have those before. The earth was, again, almost uniformly tropical and lush, and that's all gone now. Well, it's mostly gone now. We have just narrow bands of tropical areas. And the rest, you know, we have some pretty harsh conditions. Most of the earth is unlivable. A lot of the earth, most of it's water. And a lot of areas that aren't water are desert or mountainous areas. that are just very tough to grow food and very tough to live. But that's part of the judgment of that post-flood world. And that has decreased, that has contributed to decreasing our lifespan. In addition to that, our genetics are much narrower. There were billions of people, hundreds of millions, if not billions of people on the earth. That was a wide, genetic range. And that was all shrunk down to 8 people. And as I talked about in the last podcast, it was okay for Cain to marry his sister or niece. And there was no prohibition against marrying a close relative because our genetics were much purer. And we had a much wider gene pool. We had hundreds of millions, if not billions of people. But all those people were narrowed down into one family. And we are all descendants of either one or more of Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So because of that, because of the genetics narrowed down, and any scientist will tell you, any biologist will tell you, that the more genetic differentiation you have and the more genetic variety you have in a species, the healthier the species will be. It's called hybrid vigor. You can look that up. You can Google that for yourself. And the narrower the genetic material, the more sickly the descendants will become. That's why, for example, dogs who are purebreds, while very beautiful, are more likely to have some genetic conditions that will decrease their lifespan. Whereas dogs who are mixed, we call them mutts, M-U-T-T-S, mutts, live longer than purebreds and are healthier than purebreds because they have more genetic differentiation that will make up for a lot of the deficiencies in purebreds. Right now, humanity, we're more purebreds. We are all the descendants of 6 people, Noah's 3 sons and their wives. So we don't have, so that's why we're sicklier and live and don't live as long as the antediluvians, in addition to also not having that hyperbaric effect with all the healing that would come from having a more oxygen-rich environment. Okay, so that's that. I'm over my half an hour limit, so sorry about that. So it's time now. I'm going to end this podcast. Hopefully you got some understanding of what the pre-flood world was like, the antediluvian period, and some interesting information on what the flood did to our world as we know it, and where the flood came from, and the fact that it was a global flood. So in the next podcast, we're going to shift back to talking about more biblical doctrine. And we'll be talking about faith. The people of the antediluvian period had great knowledge, but they didn't believe in God. They knew about God. They had knowledge of God, but they didn't believe in God. And that may sound odd, but when you think about it, there are lots of people who have knowledge of the Bible. There are people in every, just about every university who study the Bible, but they're not necessarily believers. You can have all the knowledge in the world of the Bible, but if you don't believe in God, then it makes no difference at all. There are tons and tons of historians who use the Bible as one of their historical record, one of their books of historic record, but they don't actually believe in God or believe in Christianity. They just see the Bible as another historic reference, no different than the ancient Sumerian or Egyptian or Assyrian or Greek, Roman, whatever. It's another history book. So you can have knowledge of God and not believe in God. The people in the antediluvian period had knowledge of God, but they didn't have belief. That's because they lacked faith. Faith is that bridge between what you know and what you believe. And in the next podcast, we're going to begin a series on faith. What is faith? Is faith rational or irrational? And why is faith so important to God? Why is it so important to God that we have faith in Him? There are some very good logical reasons, and we're going to get into them in the next podcast. So thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Happy New Year to you. And we will talk again next week when we begin to explore faith.